Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. This season, we hear from the guest speakers from ISF's 2021 Digital Congress. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin speaks with the co-founder of Apple, Steve Wozniak. Woz reminisces about the past, discusses the current role of big tech, considers the future of security, and more.
Steve, thanks very much for joining me at our Congress all the way from California.
Yes, very good. I'm very honored to be a part of this Congress because it's so important in everyone's lives these days.
It is. And this is a really interesting session for me because we're doing something that we don't normally do at one of our digital congresses, and that is we're doing a whole keynote given over to questions coming from our members. So I'm not entirely certain about what some of the questions are going to be, so that's going to be interesting from my side, and I may chip in and try and answer some of them as well with you. It's going to be fun, trust me. Let's start with the first question that's come in here. This really is about you as an individual, and it's a question from one of our members over in the Netherlands. He would like to know, what was your initial motivation to get started with technology in general?
That was like the most fun period in my memories. You know, it was before we had anxieties and worries and things were so important or anything. It was accidental. I look back, you know, I try to say, where did my past come from? This is how it came. I exposed myself to this. I was interested in that. It was mostly accidental. And I really credit my mom for all of it because one day we had just moved to Silicon Valley and I was in third grade and she spent maybe 10 minutes to half an hour with me going through flashcards for multiplication. The next day I went to class and the teacher said it was the first time ever a boy beat the girls on the flashcard exams. I start thinking of myself as good at math. What you're good at is what you value. And math turned out to be a real good inlet into where I went. My father was an electrical engineer, and that was probably important, but he did not push engineering on any of us. I just fell in love with electronics. We moved into a new neighborhood in Silicon Valley when Silicon Valley was all trees and orchards, as far as you could see to the mountains. That's all it was. And we had little neighborhoods springing up for Lockheed Martin. The space race was on. And half of the kids on my block had engineers for parents. Half of the kids were getting a little instruction about electronic parts of the old days, and they became my group. They were my friends. You know, which friends you have, kind of, that also inspires you to go ahead. And I was a little older, so I was usually the leader. And I liked it. It was interesting. To me, it was just that it was fun. Hook these parts together, and you can make some lights flash. You can impress people. We didn't have it in school, electronics and that sort of thing. But outside of school, you could just do whatever you wanted, and science fairs. Science fairs are not for school assignments. They're not generally for school grades. Just think of something to do that's interesting and scientific. And I had some success with those, and that helped inspire me. So early inspiration in my heart. The mathematics also led me ahead of my friends. When you start hooking electronic parts together, there's a lot of mathematics, very complicated mathematics, and you have to learn a ton of it, like to get a ham radio license, which I had by 10 years old, where I took hundreds of parts, soldered them all together with a soldering iron. I became a constructor, a builder, to build my own ham radio. And I'd read a book where some people called ham radio operators overturned some kidnappers because of their knowledge of electronics. And these sort of things inspired me, but I'm going to say for everyone, it's accidental. Whether you see a science fiction movie and you say, I want to be like that, or you read about some inventor, oh, I want to be an inventor. It kind of happens gradually and not seen that way. So the thing is, I got extremely skilled in elementary school. By the time I was 11, there were no books in bookstores about digital technology, computers, logic, chips or transistors even. No, I just discovered little manuals here and there by accident, some in the hall closet. And I said, oh my gosh, I'm doing all this stuff with ones and zeros, the computer language, and no one else does this in school. No one else knows about it. I said, this is going to be my passion for life. You know, I might have said crossword puzzles. I love doing crossword puzzles and playing with words, and that would be my passion for life. So it got into my soul at a very early age, and I was so good at it. All through school, that motivation drove me to where I would never have to worry about getting a job or anything. You know, you go off and you think, what am I going to do after college? No, I could get a job right out of high school anytime, you know, if you get advanced enough. And I was really advanced because I taught myself and I learned all sorts of tricks as digital technology started coming in. with little chips that did one thing, and then the next year a chip that did two things, two little bits. And I got so good at designing computers. Could never buy a chip, could never build a computer, but I just somehow knew how chips worked, and I got some manuals that showed the architecture of a computer, and I would design them over and over and over, and I got so good that I knew I had tricks in my head and the ability to form new tricks, and that I was designing them with half the parts of the companies making these computers. And just, it was a love in my life. Never thought I'd have a job doing it. I, out of high school, I didn't even think computer design was an engineering job. It's something you got a job in. Computers just came out of places called research or the military. So it was, I just did it for love and fun. That was passion of my life. And I also told my dad, I'm gonna own a 4K computer someday. Because a 4K mini computer in 1970 was the smallest computer that you could type in a program to solve problems. And I had learned how to program. We didn't have it in our school, but I got special permission to go down to a company once a week. And I wanted that computer so bad, my dad said it cost as much as a house, especially if you include input, output. I was stunned and I said, I'll live in an apartment. I threw down the gauntlet. I'm gonna have a computer, even if I don't have other great things like houses.
Let's talk about security now, because I've got a question that's just come in here related to the design of Apple computers. And the question, this one's from Germany, was security by design, or the equivalent, was that part of your strategy in the early development of Apple products? Did you even think about security in those days?
Security by design was never, ever once thought of. Steve Jobs and I had actually had some fun exploring the world of the telephone networks, and we built little blue boxes that you put tones into a phone, and you could dial free calls anywhere in the world just by putting tones into phones. It wasn't that easy back then, and the phone company never thought people would really be able to do it. And oh my gosh, how could they have such a hole in their system? Well, security thinking comes after you create the ability to do things. It always comes secondarily, and we found out why. We had a great product. It didn't attached to anything, any networks, any wires, no two computers talked to each other. It was just sat there in front of you and worked for you, and we came up with the word personal. It's right. Personal. You own it. It's not belongs to the world or a company. And so we were far from the needs of security. The security was the computer is in your possession. That's the security. And if somebody took it, the disks weren't in computers in those early days. So no, in the early days, security consideration comes after you have problems and after you get infected. And fortunately, we were thinking very different than the rest of the computer world. So in the Apple world, security concerns did not really hit us the same as the rest of the world. Once computers got more sophisticated and personal computers started going in the direction of the mainframes and all, and the IBMs, and they were running operating systems that were vulnerable. Unix was an operating system that allowed you to be at your computer from anywhere in the world.
Right.
And that methodology has led to the big security concerns of today. We had such an unusual hacked together operating system. It wasn't really designed the normal operating system method where operating system's the core of your software. So our Macintosh computers went for an awful long time, right up to Mac OS 9, and they were so different that people, they would be probed even once the internet came. I'd watch the servers in my home being probed, you know, every second, but they weren't taken over because they just didn't follow rules of logging in from afar and all that. So we had security by accident, incredible security. Never once. I ran servers out of my home and, you know, I even programmed the routers in my home myself and did all that stuff, but never once had a computer taken over wrong. Two times I let friends bring into, I had a T1 line, my home was king of the hill. I let friends bring in a Unix machine once and another time a Linux machine. And both of them, within a week or a month, they were crying. Their computers had been totally taken over, you know, and partly blaming me. On my Macintosh computers, I never turned on one firewall option in my routers even. They just didn't need it. They just weren't set up the sort of the standard everything from everywhere world like Unix was. So we were kind of lucky for a long time in our Macintosh world. So the way it caught up to us was the Macintosh was designed, Steve Jobs didn't really know computer technology, and he had that project built without a real core operating system. A bunch of pieces you could call an operating system and then hack on some more stuff and toss on some more stuff. And it's the way the Apple II had been done, actually. And that's not a real true operating system where you have all sorts of resources and you have applications running, you have processes, and they're all intercommunicating and they have protected areas of memory and code. We didn't have that in the Macintosh. So that caught up to us eventually, and we finally had to resort and go back and get a decent operating system, which was Unix from Berkeley, the BSD. We put that into the Macintosh and called it OS 10.
Right.
And that's good. It's a good thing for the life of the machine. But from then on, yes, we are vulnerable in some ways to a lot of the standard hacking methods.
A question that builds on your response there, I think, and this one's coming from the United States. As human computing technology has become ubiquitous in most people's daily lives, what significant dangers or risks do you see to society today and going forward? And then an add-on, and if it isn't too late, what can we do to mitigate?
Security risks to society generally get down to your possessions, your assets, money in a bank. And it so often boils down to, we don't really have a bank in our iPhone. The bank is out in the data centers. Our personal computers have moved out to data centers, and they're running all of our stuff and keeping track of it. And every once in a while, huge organizations, retailers, banks, services, get hacked into and shut down for millions of users, or data gets extracted. And that's a big worry, but it's not really necessarily in your machine. The small handheld devices today don't really act like computers. And most people even use their laptops, not so much like computers, but, you know, as a terminal to get to the world. You know, so it's hard to say that people are concerned about what should I do about my own protection. Well, I don't know, because you know that every single day I get told how somebody hacked my system and they've been watching my camera on my computer and that sort of stuff. The trouble is people fall for that. People don't really understand what's possible and not. And then the explorers try to use it to get your passwords, to spoof you, to, you know, get information about you and say identity theft. And then use that to collect some of your assets from your bank. And one of the worst things of all is if they can steal your phone number. I've had it happen to me. Not my main phone number, thank God. They steal phone numbers with SIM swapping, it's called, inside of the computer networks. They, you know, if you have an account with AT&T, it should never get sold to somebody else without your permission. Mm-hmm. But they have ways of tricking the system into getting it. And if they have that, look how many times we set up two-factor authentication. I log into my bank, and it sends a message back to a code back to my phone. What if somebody else has the phone? This is, you know, without knowing your password, that can get by things. And that's something horrible that people should be aware of and concerned of. Mostly, they have to trust the entities that are running their services, you know, be it Facebook or Spotify or, you know, Apple Plus or anything. These services, that those people have extremely over and over layers of security that is constantly watched and managed very well, but we trust them. And you never know for sure. How can you know what you don't know is the issue. So we never know for sure that everything is totally trustable. We can't judge it by ourselves. What's in a computer is millions of lines of code, and it isn't like a set of mathematics you can learn in school and principles, and you can apply them yourself. No, you have to trust others. Even the head in a company, a large company, has maybe a CTO, you know, or a CIO, but has to rely on all the people beneath them to try to give their input that comes from millions of others. And you can never be 100% sure these days. It's so easy to make one tiny error that has a huge impact. Our systems should be designed to be robust. The word robust means if you make even major changes on the input data, you get very little fluctuation of the output. Mm-hmm. It's very stable. The opposite of that is a tiny little mistake leads to a huge, huge, horrible outcome. And the trouble is, you know, we all pretty much accept that you can never fix it for sure 100%. Here comes the most secure, you know, operating system in an iPhone, and they come out with an immediate, you better update immediately all your phones, your watches and computers, and sometimes your Apple TV. And so that means is the smartest people in the world developing these systems, watching for intrusion abilities, watching for security, are discovering there's new ones, you know, all the time. It never stops. You know, and that's too bad because we're always changing things. And every change might introduce more bugs than it fixed. And we learned that. We've learned that ever since. That started 40 years ago with IBM, actually, that same principle.
Yeah. So another one that's just come in as you were talking there. In your view, will the cybersecurity industry ever be one step ahead of the criminals? Or are we forever destined to be chasing them?
We are forever destined to be chasing them just because human errors in your setups or in your programming can leave holes, and you can't say what human errors. Are we going to prevent human errors forever? when we're changing software and all that. No, I think it's constantly a game because there's a big motivation in people. Sometimes it's not financial. Sometimes just white hat hackers trying to see if I can get through something I'm not supposed to, you know, breaking the barriers down. And I kind of admire that part. But the trouble is, they're smart people. They are the smartest networking people in the world trying to get into networks and find a little flaw, a little something somebody didn't think of, you know, and buffer overflow. You send extra data and maybe it causes an effect. And so it's hard to say. I think you're always going to be in watching what's happening on the outside, the intrusion attempts, and then making sure you can block them quickly. We could watch better. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Maybe we can come up with techniques for watching better and having little supervisor programs that are watching all the transactions, and like artificial intelligence. Is something going on that isn't the normal, that seems somehow fits some categories of unusualness? I think artificial intelligence applied this way would be a good thing to making us safer. So all we can really do is make us safer. Now, can we make us very safe? Partition things. Don't run everybody on a huge database, every single user of, you know, some bank or some Facebook or Coinbase, every single user in one place. Spread them out to small, distinct partitions, individual things. So even if one gets hacked into, not everything, you know, everybody gets affected. We can cut the effect down when something like that happens. Look at it this way, too. There's inside and outside intrusions in the cybersecurity world. And a CEO of a company is going to have a password that can get to every file. That is one thing that should be stopped. Even the high-level executives should have some extreme verification protocols to go through, because if somebody gets their password, it's game over.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question that's come in, which is related to that point, which is how can we influence computer users to act in a more secure way? You made the point there about the CEO and the password. But in general terms, how can we help educate users more so that we're all coming at it from the same perspective, I guess?
The greatest education, I think, comes from family members who are aware of the problem and advise their relatives, sometimes parents and older relatives, of what to watch out for and how to be safe. I think that's the biggest thing going on now. The second, of course, is catching news items and wondering, how does this happen? But the real best way of all of learning things is not like academic education. It's not being told things. It's pain. It's pain. A motorcyclist learns to wear a heavy coat because they fell and they suffered the pain. And even with young children, it is possible for parents to bring them up and deliberately let them get, in a supervised way, close to something that will pain them. And then they will learn forever early rather than discovering it on their own, because they're always protected from any pain. And that applies to cybersecurity in the people that get bit. Remember it and tell others about it and say how important it is to protect. But I do not see that there's an educational way that gets to people. Theoretically, we could have different types of schooling where a big part of it is be skeptical of everything. Ask every question you can and be sure. Teach at a young age, because then it'll stay with you for life. It's very hard to teach a lot of people to live a life always being careful of security when they're past 23 years old. Your personality has settled down by the time you're 23. And your personality of how much you're going to pay attention to things or care about them is not going to change through your whole life. So get them when they're young, especially if they can be close to seeing, you know, an incident, even if they can just see a friend get really hurt and a phone number stolen, some identity theft and passports grabbed out of the mail, all that kind of stuff. If you're close and see it, that's when you learn. That's the pain.
You made a point earlier about the amount of effort that big tech puts into building infrastructure networks and the skill sets that they have available to them. A question here is, do you think that big tech companies are already too big for society to keep them under control? Or are we headed to a world where big companies will potentially anyway overrule requirements of either individuals or individual countries? So question really around the power of big tech. How do we control it? Is it out of control?
I can't really answer it with absolute facts and details. All my life, I've had the concern that we all grow up with that, oh, the big, huge companies kind of control everything, and they also weed out innovation. Innovation can only happen if it goes through us, or we're allowed to limit it because it conflicts or competes with us. That's been a factor in companies for, I don't know, maybe thousands of years. So, and I grew up being on the side of the little guy. I'm for the little guy not being, I want more equality, not being sort of total under the control of the one with the power, with the money and the wealth, which is the company. And these big companies don't necessarily give the little guy innovators, like we were when we started Apple, don't give them the opportunity to come out and do something important. However, a lot of small companies, I don't know, I just read an article the other day that Apple acquires something like company a week or company a day or two companies a day, some huge number. Small little people do something really good. They're bright people, acquire their company. And when you're the big guy, you don't acquire them for usually billions of dollars, maybe Facebook does, but acquire them and then either merge it into what you have and use it or shut it down. I mean, look what Siri came along before we had any personal assistants. And it was a third-party app. And it was great. It used Wolfram Alpha technology to give really great answers to questions you'd never think a computer could answer. And Apple bought it after a year, bought Siri. And that's good. So the little guys, where's there been? In recent times, let's say the last decade, there have been an explosion of Internet of Things devices in your home.
Right.
Not just big things you already have, a TV building in some smarts and calling itself a smart TV, but, you know, things like garage, good Lord, I should check my garage door and make sure it's down here on my watch. I mean, gave us incredible abilities to control things in our home, you know, lights, garage doors, other, you know, even our appliances. And that I consider good. And little companies came up with these ideas. There are actually ideas where one person who's well-trained and has a breadth of skills involved in developing a product or being an engineer will come up with a little product on their own, in their home, in their garage, whatever you want to call it, in their bedroom, and come up with something and make a prototype and have it working that actually winds up being a great product. You know, it's a, you start with a prototype and you can start a company if it's good enough and worth it. It's hard to tell which ones are going to go. I remember when Uber came, I said, forget it. We have taxis. We have cars. You know, so I'm not always right on that. You can't ever be right. But some of these things are home runs. And so Internet of Things is smaller devices that can be built on small little computers, sometimes a little $10 Raspberry Pi. I've developed a bunch of projects on those myself. And they can actually become very, very appreciated and useful to people. It started a long time ago, probably with Roomba. Mm-hmm. My gosh, such an easy device and did such a job so well.
Right. I mean, you just said maybe you're not too good at predicting the future. Let me ask you this question, which you may be uncomfortable with, but what do you think could be the next big game changer as far as technology is concerned?
I read the same papers as everyone else. Go to analysts like Gartner that are really experienced at studying every single company and project. They're more key to what's going to be disruptive probably than just an individual. Of course, we always hear about quantum computing, and it's a dream that may or may not happen. You can't say it won't. But replacing general computers, it really has been a long time trying and not getting there. There's artificial intelligence is sort of the one you hear about the most. And I hate it every time I hear about something with AI because it's not intelligence. It's just the highest application of computers today that can sort of watch what you do and then kind of learn what things are out of the regular. That would be good for watching big data centers for intrusion attempts. And what you do normally, so when you start typing words, it sort of knows which one you're most likely to type out of all the possible choices. These things are good things, but I don't call them intelligence.
Right.
You can show 80,000 pictures of dogs to Google, I say this a lot, and Google can recognize a dog faster than any human being alive. And you say that's intelligence. Like we used to say, playing chess is intelligence. And these are just really algorithms applied to where if you play a million games, a billion games of chess, and remember them all, if a human could do that, you'd be the smartest human in chess in the world. But it's not really intelligence. Do we know how the mind works playing chess? We don't know how the mind is wired or how it works. I guarantee that. I studied as a psychology major at Berkeley, and we just sort of have little tidbits of things we can detect, and we sort of pretend we know how it might work. We don't even know that memories are in the brain. Much better evidence that memories are in your teeth, believe it or not. So if we knew how the brain was wired, we could build one. I was at a company once, and the engineers did come up with how to make a brain. It takes 9 months.
Very good. Very good. So given that perspective on artificial intelligence, AI, machine learning, call it what you will, what do you think the best application for that is going forward from a security standpoint? Because a lot of our members, you know, are looking to machine learning in particular as a way of perhaps overcoming some of the more mundane elements of security, things like network monitoring and that kind of thing, things that perhaps people are not that good at. But to your point about algorithms, that is something that the machine could take over. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, this issue of security and intrusion attempts, has become so huge, and we generally have centralized systems, not spread out into a lot of small ones. And, you know, if attackers get by, it's so bad. So we put in every kind of block we can and steps they have to go through and security the wrong people can't get in. We try to do everything we can. We get up to some good two-factor authentication, helps, unless your phone number gets stolen. But then there's the authenticators, like Google Authenticator, that, you know, have a running code. And we get some better techniques, but it still doesn't work 100%. A lot of the intrusion attempts are just trying to get your password or someone else's important password in a company. Friends with Kevin Mitnick, he has a lot of very funny books on successful attempts in that regard. One time, he called the president of a company that he was going to do penetration tests for and get paid to find ways to intrude their system, their voicemail or something, and the voicemail would listen to your voice, say in a phone number, and know that it's you. Right. So what he did was he called into the president from, he spoofed a number that had every one of the 10 digits. And then he asked that president of the company while he was talking to him to read back the number that he saw on his phone that Kevin had dialed from. Now he had a recording of every one of the 10 digits. And while he was on the phone, he used those to get into the guy's voicemail and set a special voicemail. Guess who this is? And he then told the president, why don't you check your voicemail now? Yeah, he got paid some money for that. You see, there's trouble is human beings are trickable. It's called social engineering. And that's something we have to live with. On the artificial intelligence side, you could have supervisory programs. Just looking at the sort of activity that's coming in regularly and from whom, and does it make sense or are they doing something unusual today? Watch for the unusual occurrences and then notify some of the humans that are in charge of operating the equipment right then. Another case was Novell was a company that ran networks way back in the time, you know, the IBM PC days. And he was running that computer network. And he got a phone call. Well, Kevin Mitnick had, first of all, he got the name of one of the employees. And somehow he went in, the employee had the default on his voicemail. So he's changed the voicemail to be one of his own voice, Kevin Mitnick's voice, rather than the executive in the company. And he phoned our friend, Sean Nunley, and he said, oh, look, I'm out of town. I forgot my password. Can you give me a password to get in? Mm-hmm. And Sean was very suspicious of this. And Kevin said, you can go check my voicemail. You know, John Evans' voicemail. Right. And Sean called it. Yeah, it was the same voice. So he gave him a password. This social engineering, we're never going to quite get away from. But a supervisory program might have still spotted instantly after that a bunch of activity inside the computer, the operating system. Sometimes we have to make things slower. And we have to take more steps. And that costs more money to have greater security. And old companies don't want to, you know, have it more costly to have two side-by-side servers, and if one gets crashed, the other has enough data to continue and has recorded what transactions have expired. That's, you know, redundancy is one other technique that we can use, and we don't seem to use it very well because look at all the ransomware attacks. They get away with it. I mean, the instant a ransomware attack comes in, you should be able to back up. Every event that came in should have been stored somewhere and repeatable into a backup computer that was good 10 minutes ago.
Right.
But it costs money. It costs a lot of money for the transactions.
Okay, somebody here looking for some career tips for next generation. And one of our members here, actually in Finland, says, was, when looking back at the cream soda and homebrew times, would you say this kind of thing is still possible today? So I guess, you know, if you rolled it forward, if you were starting again with Steve Jobs in the apartment, not in the garage, do you think it would be possible again for you to create an Apple today?
Oh, yes, because people always want to be around other creative people espousing ideas, kind of like science fiction and forming groups. I don't think in the same computer world. That one's just grown up and been so big and it's established and large companies define it more than just individual ideas. There are groups, of course, that still meet, but are they going to actually produce new outstanding ideas and companies that change our life? Not as likely in the computer world, but they're going to be exploring anything. There might be car clubs and somebody figures out how to make a new type of engine or feed it better or get more performance and better wires and something major that changes life, you know, forever. That could still come from the small realm because if you look back in history, it almost always has. There almost always have been people that had very little, nothing. Like Steve Jobs and I had no bank accounts. We had no business experience. And Steve himself didn't have any real academic background. But people come up like that throughout history and achieve great things. Look at our personal computer, the digital world that we have today. And it started with companies where people dropped out of college, not even college degrees to do it. you know, Paul Allen and Bill Gates, Steve Jobs and myself, and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg. You're in a college and you say, something is so interesting, it's going to drive me. So it's people who are driven by interesting ideas and the ability to even impress and show off. I was so shy, I couldn't talk to people, but I could show them my designs by getting respect for that. That was what was important to me, not starting a company, not starting an industry. I like the fact that the IEEE has made me a fellow. Other engineers acknowledged my work was great, because that was really the important thing in my life. So there's different types, there's different categories of people, and there's some. Now, you really want to have a broad spectrum, like I said before, of skills. For example, I could come up with an idea of a product that I wanted for myself. The best products come from that. Steve Jobs and the iPhone, Elon Musk and the Tesla S. They come from somebody who wants it for themselves and defines it in terms of themselves. It turns out sometimes a lot of other people want that. You know, what drives you? What drives you is the important thing. It's not so much that you have the skills and the knowledge, but more you have the motivation to get to a goal. So what I did was I came up with ideas, thought out in my head. I go through chip manuals. I'm thinking, what chips are available? Here's a way I can do it very efficiently with something available that's affordable. I always thought in terms of affordability because I had no money. Right. That was a really good thing. And then I would lay out the chips. I'd plug the chips into a board in my office at HP, you know, late at night. I'd do it on my own. And I would hook up thousands of wires, solder them, mark them off, figure out what's working on the equipment, the oscilloscopes, and fix things and change parts. And then I'd write the software that would test it out and make it work. And I'd build the prototype. I covered so many skills that normally would have been a technician for this, a technician for that, an engineer designs this, business people come up with the idea of what you're going to do. Had it all in one person, you can move 10 times as fast rather than designing things by committee. And that'll happen in this world. Young people that get a good broad education, I suggest robotics. In robotics, you have to deal with electronics, the old analog electronics that I believe in so heavily. It was so mathematical to know what kind of power will drive a motor and how to protect the motor from burning other parts out and things like that. That's electronics. You have to know mechanics, what will and won't work and what'll fail and be too weak to like raise an arm in the robot. You have to have microprocessors that have sensors that sense lighting conditions and things like who's close to me and time of day and everything, even Wi-Fi. You have to have radio knowledge. You have to do your software to make the robotics work. So personal robotics is a category to get into, and there are so many jobs. You know, every company getting products delivered automatically, going down a production line and the robots that assemble things right up to cars. That's a really good field. That field never go away. And cybersecurity. It's the biggest one of all. You want to be sure of a job. Be a cybersecurity expert, but don't just be a weenie. I mean, if you're going to go into something, make it a point. You're going to be great, one of the greatest ever, and excellent at it. You're going to think of ideas that other people don't think of, and not just, I got through college, I'll just do what I do and go home and drink beer and watch TV. No, don't waste your youth. Look at the companies in the personal computer industry that I mentioned, you know, from Facebook and Microsoft and Google and Apple, all started from very young people that weren't already into here's how things are done in the world. Mm-hmm. So we were able to very easily, you know, break barriers, think out of the box, think differently.
Some really good ideas there for people who are thinking about maybe startups, entrepreneurial businesses they're perhaps working on in the background. I've got another question here that's just come in, which is really related to things that you might do differently. And the question is, if there was one thing you could have changed relating to Apple, what would that have been?
Well, I look back sometimes and I say, what advice would I give myself back then? And the advice is, rob a bank. Plain and simple. Rob a bank. You've got a few more funds to make a little higher quality of your first products, not have to make some sacrifices because of that.
Right. Was that one of the reasons why you went down a pure open source route for the first Apple machines? Was that something to do with it? Was it easier to get hold of and cheaper? And
everything in the analog world was open source. When you bought a television, it came with manuals showing every single part, how they're connected, and you could actually probe inside. I was a television engineer too. I mean, I could actually take anybody's color television and probe around and repair it. I could be a television repairman. We had repairmen in every city. When your television went bad, you take it to a repairman, or you pull out the tubes and go down to the grocery store and test your tubes, and it says one of them's bad, and you buy a new one. These were different times, so that's all I really knew. As a matter of fact, how did I come up with, okay, the Apple One put video on a television. Mm-hmm. But before that, I'd already developed video games like Atari Breakout I did for them, and I built my own little Pong game, not their Pong, and it put stuff on my TV. Well, I unscrewed the back of the television. I pulled open the open source documents and saw where the video is coming in on it. I probed around. I saw how strong the video was and what direction, up or down. Mm-hmm. And then I built my device that would put that kind of video straight into my TV through a wire. There was no video in jack back then. So the open source really was how you got to do things and use them for other things. And that's just how you did it. Now, some people might say Steve Jobs was into not open source and not closed. That came about more later. If we had come out with the Apple II and Steve Jobs had every single decision over it, he still would have made it open source, because we grew up in an electronics era where that was just, you know, what you were very used to. Open source kind of goes away when, I don't know, you want to own things more yourself. Other people can't get in and extend it. And we want more of the credit. It's control. And I mentioned earlier, I'm against the companies having that power and control. And open source should allow other people not only to be open source, but to be able to go in, modify things, make enhancements, redo them their way, or repair them themselves. And that's how we grow. You look at what someone else did, you come up with another idea that would apply a little better to a different product. And somebody else builds on that. We build on the work that's been done before, and that's what open source allows. And I've been a strong open source advocate all along, and I know that Apple went more in the proprietary route. And eventually you can be open source and proprietary and still stop anybody from touching anything that you have. Open source is very difficult today. Think about the software, which really makes your smartphone or your computer work. Has software be a million lines of code. 10,000 key engineers might have written parts of it. And you can't get a hold of those people. You couldn't go through the open source and really find the flaws, because you can't. It's so huge, you as one person can't rewrite it. You can't rewrite it. You have to trust it. What if there's something in there that is malware, that's watching you, that's putting signals out to the internet and spying on you? What if it's in there? You'd never find it. The skilled engineers that create the products, even in a company like Apple, can't necessarily find little things that got snuck in by some engineer. So it's a difficult world we live in. Everything is software these days, and software is just too huge.
I'm aware of time. We've probably got time for a couple more questions. There's one here from Sweden. Anything in your career you wish you could experience again?
People I met. let's see, what could I experience again in my career? You know, I don't know, just every idea I ever came up with, inventions. I had 10 years of my life where some magic I can't explain was pouring out of my head. Like Bob Dylan had 10 years where what came out of his mind? How could anyone think of these words? I look back at my own designs. How did anyone think of that? So it's not just one thing. It's kind of like everything. Is there one experience that stands out more than the others? If I went through and took enough time, I'd think of a few experiences that were really incredible. Oh, the floppy disk. I'm going to pick the floppy disk for the Apple II computer. My gosh. We started out and our programs were on cassette tapes like songs.
Right.
So if you wanted to run a checkbook program, you picked out a little cassette tape and it said checkbook. It's like the check. And you played it on a cassette player into the computer. Computer got beep, 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 got the data just like over a modem and ran the checkbook program. But then after about a year, we had a list of about 10 projects we should get into. And I'd been doing one after another, printer interfaces, modem interfaces, that sort of thing. And we had a staff meeting, and our CEO or president at the time, Mike Markula, he was an equal partner to Steve Jobs and myself. And he ran the meeting and he said, Apple is going to be allowed into the CES show in Las Vegas, Consumer Electronics Show. Oh, any young people interested in technology, this is where you see the newest TVs, the newest VCRs, the newest of everything electronic, and you want to go? And he said, but we're only going to send three marketing people to show the Apple II. And it was going to be himself, he headed marketing, Steve Jobs, of course, and I think our sales guy, Gene Carter. And I sat there, I'm just not the type who would raise my hand. I'm a founder, I want to go to Las Vegas, I want to see the lights. I have always wanted to see that city. I'm too shy to say that. I raised my hand, and I can't explain why I said it. I said, if we have a floppy disk, can we show it? Okay, I had never worked with disk hardware or software of any kind in my life or studied it. So, except I'd done the cassette tape interface, which has a little relevance. And Mike Markula said, yes. And I'm sitting there through the rest of the staff meeting, not even listening. If I can come up with a way to develop a floppy disk controller in 2 weeks, the show is 2 weeks away, if I can do it in 2 weeks, they'll have to take me because I'll be the only one that understands it. And I sat down and I started studying a disk drive that Steve Jobs got for me right away from Shugart, a new smaller one. I started studying all their electronics. I wound up taking their 20 chips out. Not needed. We have a computer. We can supply the signal straight to the read head and the write head and the one that advances tracks. And I sat there for 2 weeks. I worked every day, Christmas, New Year's, day and night. Had one high school programmer that we'd hired out of high school, Randy Wigginton, working with me. And in 2 weeks, I had it working, and I got to go to Las Vegas, the show. And I have many memories of pranks I played in that trip, but that's for another book.
And a final question for you, Steve. What do you regret the most of not doing?
I brought my head up not to have concerns about the world, not to have stress, and not to worry about the things you don't do. For one thing, you get to a certain point in your age, you might even be dying, like Steve Jobs. And what I told him was, you aren't judged by what you don't do that you could do in the future, but you won't be doing. You're judged by what you did do when you were here. It's kind of like celebrate the good that you did and not, oh, something that you might do and might miss. Do I have any bucket list things that I might have ever missed? No, I really don't want to say that because it may not be true. It's like looking back and saying, if we had made a different decision at Apple, we would have been much better. You can't go back and change things. So why have the stress and the grief? The grief is what I want to get around. My formula for life is not accomplishment. It's happiness. How happy you are in your life. Maximize that. And the way you maximize it is a formula that I use. Smiles minus frowns. Have a lot of fun in your life, even while you're working, and avoid the frowns. And if you look back and said, if we'd only done something different, well, that's a frown. Mm-hmm. You don't want that in your life. Arguing with people, don't argue with anyone, ever. You know, and you won't have frowns. You don't really accomplish anything by arguing. Write good thoughts down, have your opinions, and don't be bad to others. Make everyone like you. So these were principles I used to have the happiness in my life. So I had it made. I didn't need anything like Apple to happen to make me successful in my life, in my terms. Now I only get upset at one category of thing. When you do the right steps as a human and a computer doesn't understand you or doesn't work anymore, when technology is bad because it's people like me that created things in the world that could have been so much better. And that's about the only thing that bothers me. It sounds like my wife, but the only thing that bothers her is everybody else is driving.
Smiles and frowns. Steve, I think that's a great way to leave it. So thank you very much indeed for taking the time. I hope our members appreciated your very candid responses to their questions. Steve Wozniak, been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
What an honor.
Thanks so much to this week's guest, Steve Wozniak. Next week, Steve is in conversation with trust expert, author, and lecturer at Oxford University, Rachel Botsman. Here's a preview of that conversation.
Deep trust is formed not when people fit in, it's when they belong, when they feel that true sense of belonging. And that comes from an organization's purpose. So there's so much work being done on purpose of the organizations, but you see it like often when people join organizations or the way people advertise to new talent, trying to attract new talent, is they talk about still what they're selling, what they're offering, things that they're creating, and people cannot connect with the why of that organization. And if people really believe in the why of that organization, that's what pulls great talent in.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org. Which is also where you can find the catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.